This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Messerall. Are you ready to discover your True North Story?
Gottman, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence and time.
Thank you. That's a nice compliment.
I've been an admirer from afar of your work, you and your wife, and the Gottman Institute, and all that you have done for couples and families and people who are looking for connection and relationships.
Thank you.
That's part of what this podcast is all about. We like to hear people's stories. It's called True North Story. So that means that we all have purpose in life and we don't always know what that purpose is right away, but eventually we find it. So can you tell us a little bit about what got you interested in studying psychology to start off?
Well, I started off in mathematics and physics as an undergraduate and really enjoyed math. And I went to MIT to get a PhD in mathematics. That's what my goal was. But my roommate, you get randomly assigned to a roommate at MIT in your first year. You live at the graduate house. My roommate was studying psychology at MIT. His name was William Bruce. And I found his books a lot more interesting than my books. So, you know, I got really interested in psychology and I decided to take a year off. I was only, you know, 20 years old. And I decided to take a year off and see the United States and then finally decided to apply to graduate school in psychology. So that's what got me to switch to psychology from mathematics. And my parents thought it was too big a switch. And they were opposed to my doing this, but, you know, I was pretty adamant, and I got accepted to the University of Wisconsin, where I really wanted to go to graduate school.
You know, that's really interesting, Dr. Gottman, that you bring up the parents, because one of the interesting things that Tam and I see in a lot of people's True North journey is that the parents were either incredibly supportive, or they might be a little bit reticent in saying, hey, I think that's a good idea. And so it sounds to me like your parents were a little skeptical of the switch there.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I started studying couples, my father said, who's going to read a whole book about marriage? And my mother said, well, Saul, maybe you need to.
That's great. I would say you work out of both sides of your brain. You've got that math and analytics side, and then you've got the socio and relational side, and you were able to kind of combine the two. That's where the math and the analytics come in studying couples, right?
Yes, actually, you know, I went back to using mathematics and collaborated with James Murray in getting differential equations for couples interaction. We actually wound up writing a book called The Mathematics of Marriage, which ironically was published by MIT Press. So it kind of came full circle. The math wound up getting used to study relationships.
So did you stay at University of Wisconsin in Madison, and then is that where you dove in and got all the psychology and all of that there?
You know, I was real interested in children. Became a child psychologist, so I studied children originally and families. And some of the best scientists were there looking at love relationships. For example, Harry Harlow, who was at the Primate Center studying mother-infant love. Mavis Hetherington, who was one of my mentors, really studying family interaction. She went on to study the effects of divorce on children. And so, you know, that's kind of where I began. And my training was really in looking at interaction in families and looking at how kids develop in families and how parent-child interaction affects children's development.
You know, it's really interesting because I can remember growing up, and there were, you know, fellow friends or students that I went to school with that were in families with single parents. And of course, obviously, that has changed dramatically in the 20 plus years since all of that. But how did your studies change as society has changed? We have more and more single parents, higher and higher divorce rate. That's got to kind of be amazing because I'm looking at, you know, your history over multiple decades.
How does that change? I think that's very true, John. You know, the thing about Wisconsin that was so interesting was that they emphasized observing and just getting mm-hmm. basic observational data on things. And also, you know, they emphasized looking at physiology. So that's kind of the methods that I developed with my friend Bob Levinson when we started doing this research. I continued to be interested in children and parenting. Part of what I wanted to discover was what happens to safeguard kids when there's a divorce, and what happens in single-parent families. What can moms do, or dads if they're the caregiver, to make sure that that child develops in a healthy way emotionally? We actually used our research to discover a thing called emotion coaching, where basically a parent becomes a coach of a kid's emotional experience, kind of like a coach, like an athletic coach. You don't have to be an Olympic coach to actually coach children about their emotion. You just have to really be able to listen to them and tune into them and treat them with honor and respect. And it turns out that kids, when you do that, kids, as we followed them from age 10 months all the way up through the teen years, kids develop emotional intelligence. And we discovered this emotion coaching, and it's worked everywhere on the planet where we've tried it. South Korea, Turkey, Australia, United Kingdom, everywhere in the United States as well. Everywhere it's been tried, it's really been effective, which is kind of amazing that the things we've discovered in the cities in which we've done the research have turned out to be really universal and hold across cultures. So it does. We do have something to say to single parents about how to really be effective parents, even though there's not a co-parent around. And the answer is emotion coaching.
The old adage is you can't pick your family, you can't pick your parents. And unfortunately, in some cases, there's a lot of dysfunction or a lot of emotional immaturity that is brought into a family situation by the parent themselves.
That's a good point.
Being able to educate them or help them be better parents, that has to help the child's development too, right?
That's very true. And, you know, and where do you learn this stuff? I mean, you know, you don't learn it when you go to a hospital to give birth. You don't learn it in church or school, how to be a great parent, how to be a great partner. And so through research, we've been able to discover the very simple skills that one needs to really be effective parent and as a partner as well.
What are some of those top skills that you've identified?
Bob Levinson and I have followed couples, you know, the same group of couples for as long as 20 years. And we know that some people really are masters of relationship. They're naturally just better at relationships. Mm-hmm. They're better parents. They're better partners. What we discovered is that the most important thing they do and the skill they have is they seem to operate with a motto that says, you know, baby, they say to their partner, when you're upset, the world stops and I listen. And that's really probably the most important skill, that skill of emotional connection. And that's why we wrote The Man's Guide to Women, because men have a huge role to play in making this work, making relationships work, making families work. I mean, one of the things that we teach in our Bringing Baby Home program is how important fathers are. And nobody's more surprised by that than fathers, that they really matter, and that husbands really matter, that men really make a difference in relationships.
That is really powerful stuff. You know, and we see that, socially speaking, we're seeing that in the African-American community, too.
Some
of the issues that they're having to navigate through is because of a lack of a strong male figure in a family setting. It's a huge problem. I think there is a role that men play, and I think part of that role is that they need to understand listening to the other part of the relationship.
And we've studied African-American families as well, and the master African-American men who are great partners and great fathers really have this kind of a model where they're saying, I'm going to be there, and, you know, and I'm going to be present. I'm going to care about the emotions of my kids. I'm going to care about the emotions of my partner. And they hang in there, and it makes all the difference, because the thing that men really complain about in relationships is there's too much fighting and not enough sex. Turns out that a couple of social skills can change all of that. And when people are about to have their first baby or their second baby or third baby, they really are interested in learning these skills that'll help them be better parents and help them make through the transition from being lovers to being parents. And so a couple of skills that they learn really makes all the difference.
Dr. Gottman, how did you and Julie meet? And what was it about her that was attractive to you right at the first?
That's a great question. Well, you know, we'd both been in previous failed relationships. And I think we had each been divorced for about, I think she'd been divorced for 5 years and I'd been divorced for about 7 years when we each moved to Seattle. And I had a lot of time on my hands before school started. And so I decided I was going to get to know Seattle and I was going to answer personals ads. This is before the internet. And so I answered every personal ads in the weekly newspaper. And I had 60 dates in 6 weeks.
6-0?
10 dates a week. That's what I did. Yeah, I decided, you know, let's take this seriously and let's kind of, you know, see what's out there and let me get to know a lot of women. And Julie was number 61, and she was a clear outlier for me. And I met her the first time we just talked on the telephone, and we were surprised that we were talking, you know, 4 hours had gone by, and we were laughing and really interested in the conversation. And then we met in this coffee house, and I got there early because I get to places early. And I sat there waiting for her, and one woman came in, and I said, oh, gee, I hope that's not Julie. I don't like the way she looks particularly. Finally, Julie came in. I thought, yeah, I hope that's her, because I like the way she looks. And it was her. And we met, you know, and we had this great conversation. And that was it. 5 months later, I proposed.
Wow.
Wow.
So you knew she was the one within 5 months.
Oh, yeah. I really knew she was the one probably after the second date. Now, we were both scared. We were both going, oh, well, you know, let's be careful, you know. But after a while, we just kind of both knew that this was going to work. But we didn't actually work together in helping couples, you know, for a long time. She was in private practice and I just did research. You know, we finally got together in a canoe out in Puget Sound and she said, you know, why don't we collaborate? And I said, okay, that sounds good. And it turned out to be a great collaboration because, you know, she had the sensitivity to really know how to reach people. And I had the data and the research methods. And so I learned a lot from her about how to convert all that information into a great theory and a therapy. So she's played a really active role as an equal in developing all of these methods.
And when she has a problem, you say, baby, the world stops. I want to hear what's going on. Is that how it goes at
That's
your
right.
house?
But sometimes I get defensive. Sometimes I'm not a good listener.
She must have a little bit of grace for you at times.
It's true. It's true. And, you know, that's what we found about the masters. Everybody screws up in relationships. It's just that the masters are better at repairing it, at coming back and saying, I'm sorry, let's try that again.
You bring up a really interesting point, Dr. Gottman, because that requires emotional maturity to say, hey, you know what? I was way off base there. I'm going to own the fact that I didn't listen to you or I didn't hear what you were saying or I could have been more sensitive. And I think about relationships. I think part of the thing for me personally is just understanding who you are yourself before you can go out and try and be with somebody else. Tam and I talk about this a lot. We all play roles. Well, what do you want me to be? Okay, I'm the guy with the good job and the fancy car, and I am working my way to the corner office. That's how I'm going to attract what I think I want, and vice
right.
versa. And we get off and we're playing these roles, and then it turns out that when you get into the situation, you're not the role you were. You're a different person, and the person feels like it's a bait and switch kind of thing. So talk to us a little bit about the success of relationships with emotionally mature people, and how do you get there to try and make your relationship more successful?
Well, you know, I hate to tell you this, John, but I don't think it takes emotional maturity.
Okay.
And I don't really think it takes knowing yourself either. I think it takes really investment and risking, really giving everything you've got in this relationship. And through the relationship, you get to know yourself better. I think you can be neurotic as hell and have a great relationship. You know, I think you hear a lot of people saying, well, you have to really love yourself first. I think that's bullshit, too. I really don't think it's true. I think, you know, I think what you have to do is really give your heart to this other person. And that takes really cherishing what you have in this relationship, and really maximizing what you see as your partner's positive qualities and minimizing the negative. We all have drawbacks. We all have things that aren't perfect in our relationship. All of us are flawed. Nobody gets out of childhood without some crazy buttons, you know, that right. make us flawed human beings. But, you know, what makes a relationship work is really emphasizing and cherishing what you have in this person, learning to understand this person. And how do we learn to understand another person? By screwing up communication and arguing and fighting. I mean, most couples, a lot of times reporters ask me, what do couples fight about? And my answer is, absolutely nothing. They don't fight about topics. They fight about failures to connect emotionally. You know, like couples watching television and, you know, they made popcorn and, you know, and she says, okay, let's watch television. He says, okay, let me see what's on. And she says, yeah, why don't you leave it at that station? That's really, I like that. That's interesting. And he says, okay, I will, but let me see what else is on. She says, no, leave it. And he says, fine, have it your way. She says, wait a minute, why'd you say it like that? That kind of hurt my feelings. And he says, I said, fine, because you can always watch what you want to watch, and we always do it your way. She says, you know, I don't want to watch television with you at all now. And then he walks out and slams the door saying, fine. What did they argue about? It wasn't finances or sex or in-laws. They just failed to connect. And if they talk about what happened, then they get closer and they understand. You know, and that's really the way it goes in a relationship. We all mess up, and then if we talk about it, then we understand each other better, and we learn to love each other better.
That's pretty powerful words, I think.
For sure.
You wanted to write a book for men about women and relationship for a long time, but it was a process for you. It was like over a decade of trying to figure out how to put pen to paper. Tell us about that process.
You know, the thing that happened was that my agent really hated the book. I wrote the book, and my agent hated it, put it away. And then, you know, I ran into Doug Abrams and I said, you know, Doug, would you do me a favor and read this book and tell me whether you think it's really bad? Because my agent thinks it really sucks. And so he read the book and he said, no, I like it. I think it's really interesting. I said, well, the data keep telling me that men are important. And I've wanted to write this book for a long time. And he said, well, let's write it together. I said, okay, that'd be great. And so he and I started working on the book. And our wives were around, and they came by, and, you know, his wife, Rachel, and my wife, Julia, came by, and they said, that's bullshit. You can't say that. You guys don't know what you're talking about. And they started arguing with us, and we said, hey, why don't all four of us write this book? Because we really wow. need a woman's point of view here. And even though we have the data, we need to know your experiences. And Rachel is a physician who specializes in women's problems, so she was a great addition. So we started basically tape recording our discussions and our arguments with one another, and that's how we wrote the book.
Learn, love, listen, live. This is True North Story, the original podcast series. And now, back to the program.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing. I want to get into it, man, you know. Like a sex machine, man. Moving, doing it, you know. Can I count it off? One, two, three, four. Get up, get on up, stay on the scene, get on up, like a sex machine, get on up.
How did you know Doug ahead of time, Dr. Gottman?
Well, we met in sort of a think tank group that Harville Hendricks organized about relationships. And Harville Hendricks and his wife, Helen Hunt, had the idea that they would invite couples to come to this. And, you know, and we were all therapists or researchers on relationships, and we came together, and Doug Abrams and his wife were there, and that's how I met them for the first time.
So was that the first time that you had ever written a book by this type of process? I mean, walk
right,
through that.
Right, totally.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
And, you know, we just tape recorded our arguments, and we had a writer, Laura Love, who was worked for Doug, and she helped us put our conversations into some form, you know, where it made sense.
Digitally recorded your conversations that sometimes were agreeing and disagreeing over certain things?
Right, exactly. It was based on just arguing, basically.
Was there anything surprising that rose to the surface? I know you've got several amazing points that you've made to men about what women want.
Most, interesting things that rose to the surface was that for a man to really love a woman and have a great sex life with a woman, he has to understand women's relationship with the emotion of fear.
What is it about fear?
You know, the interesting thing is that women, part of our evolutionary history is that women are the caretakers of children and have the ultimate responsibility in a way for their survival, even though fathers have become more nurturant and more involved. And as a result of that, women have a heightened awareness of danger because they have to keep kids safe. And also, the world is a really dangerous place for women. We know that, you know, somewhere around 40% of women in America have either been physically or sexually molested. 50% of women in the Army have been sexually abused in the Army. So the world is not a safe place for women. And so, you know, one of the things that really came out is that the number one trait that a woman looks for when she's dating in a man is trustworthiness. The first step is she has to feel that he's safe. He's a safe haven. And the interesting thing is men are looking for that too. Just like in that movie Sleepless in Seattle, Tom Hanks says when he met his wife, he came home. Not to a home he'd ever experienced, but it was like he came home for the first time. And that's what women are looking for, a safe haven. And that's step one in really them getting to know a guy. And so that idea is really essential. And we also know that the same thing is true when a woman really feels like making love. She has to feel a sense of safety and connection. She can't be stressed out. She can't be thinking about all the chores she has to do, which is why when men do housework, they have more sex. She's not as stressed out. You know, she's got a partner. She's not alone in doing all this crap work that is required in childcare and maintaining a home. So guys who are aware of the needs that women have for safety, for emotional connection, and for knowing that this situation they're in is really explicitly erotic and they agree to it, those men, you know, really have a better sex life. I mean, another thing that was so interesting to me is that the way a man reacts to a woman saying no to sex will determine how much sex he has. You know, if there's any kind of pouting and sulking and punishment, they'll tend not to have very much sex. But if a man says, hey, thank you for telling me that you're not in the mood, what are you in the mood for? In other words, no does not end connection. Are you in the mood for taking a walk? You want to watch a movie? You want to just cuddle? Do you want to talk? Do you need some alone time? If a guy responds that way to a woman saying no, then they turns out they have a lot of sex. It's not what a lot of guys do. A lot of guys are saying, you don't find me attractive. I find you attractive, and we used to have great sex. What's wrong with you? Right. What changed?
Exactly.
they get so punitive, right. Really.
Yeah. You know?
A man has to understand, you know, how dangerous a world it is for most women. Her special relationship with fear.
You're so spot on, Dr. Gottman. And I would say that not only does she want to feel physically safe, she wants to feel emotionally safe.
Exactly.
She wants to feel...
Which is why emotional connection is so important.
She wants to feel heard. She wants to feel understood. And she wants to be related to in that way.
That's right. That's right. And and this is true everywhere on the planet where we studied it in 24 separate countries. The people who have a great sex life, the guy is important. He's saying, I love you every day and meaning it. He's given her back rubs. He's given her surprise gifts, romantic gifts. They have weekly dates. There's the same thing going on everywhere. They cuddle. He listens to her. He courts her. He continues to court her. And men are a little bit better in Spain and Italy, turns out.
How about that?
No big surprise.
No.
Wow.
The Latin culture, right? The passion that's there.
Right. Chivalry is not dead.
That's right. You know, here's an interesting fact. You know, there are psychologists who tell people, you know, couples not to cuddle with one another because it's not erotic. It turned out in research that of all the people that were studied, 70,000 people in 24 countries, only 6% of the non-cuddlers had a great sex life. In other words, you need a cuddle. You need to touch one another. You need to hold hands. You need to show affection in public. You need to give your partner compliments. Men need to be saying things like, boy, baby, you look so good in that color. I'm having all these lewd thoughts about you. Those kinds of statements really make a big difference. That's why we wrote this book, A Man's Guide to Women, because it's not very complicated. It's not rocket science, and it's no mystery anymore about what it takes to have a great love life.
Answer me this. I've noticed that women become insecure about themselves when they are comparing themselves to other women.
Absolutely. Yeah, women are bombarded by these visions. You know, the estimate is 600, they see 600 images a day of women who are skinnier than them, you know, modeling clothes and, you know, younger than them. And, you know, so women are bombarded by images that make them feel like they just don't measure up. You know, the average person is not represented in Vogue magazine and all these other things that women read all the time. So, yeah, women do feel insecure about their bodies.
Right.
And that's why a man really has to communicate what he loves about her body. He's got to let her know he finds her sexy, finds her attractive, that he's interested in her. By touching, even non-sexual touching, that communicates so much that he's attracted to her, that it hasn't ended. And that's why Dave Barry's joke, the only thing you can do when your wife says, do I look fat in this, is to fall down and pretend you're having a heart attack.
Right. There's no correct way to answer that question.
There's no correct way to answer that. You have to just say, honey, you look great in everything. You know, I mean, really, I love that dress. I think you look fabulous in it. But you look great in everything. That's the way to respond, because she's thinking, I don't know. I'm not very attractive. Particularly as she gets older, right? She's thinking
sure.
That.
So how long did it take in the new process to write the book, you know, with Laura's help in terms of categorizing some of the recordings for general themes, I'm assuming, is how you kind of line that up. How long did it take before to write the book?
It took us over a year, probably a year and a half to do it, because we knew exactly what we wanted to say, and we had my manuscript to go from, which admittedly was not a very good book. But at least we had a basis. We had the data. So we knew what we wanted to say, and we knew we wanted to keep it completely scientifically credible. And that was the important thing. We don't want to go saying anything that we can't back up with facts. That's the framework.
That's amazing. Now, that book is available now, and Tam and I are going to highlight that and put links. You've written more than 40 books. Which is your favorite?
Well, The Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work is probably the best one, because it sold over a million copies, and Nan Silver and I have just revised it. So it started in 1999, and, you know, after 17 years of its being a bestseller, it's now been revised, and there's 40% more content because we've continued to do research and find out the ways in which we've been wrong. And, I mean, one of the things about being a researcher is that I found out that I was wrong 60% of the time in my hypotheses. And if I didn't do the research, if I didn't use science, I'd think I was right 100% of the time. I'm mostly wrong. And so, you know, in these 17 years, we've been able to revise our thinking and make it more accurate, more truthful, and look at the ways in which we really have failed in being able to help people and find better ways. Because in those 17 years, we've also, you know, trained almost 50,000 therapists at the Gottman Institute and run these workshops for couples, these weekend workshops, and done therapy with couples. So we're getting a chance to really test our ideas, you know, and understand the ways in which our intuitions really aren't correct.
That is amazing. So it's a kind of an evolutionary process.
It really is, yeah. And, you know, and there's a lot more to understand. I mean, it's not like we understand everything. There are so many questions we have that we don't have answers to at this point. I mean, we don't understand why it is that a lot of people, once they learn how to really do these things in a relationship, in therapy, at least 30% of them don't do it after the therapy, after successful therapy. That's a total mystery. and this is true worldwide, the World Health Organization and the CDC has found that if you take all the people that have hypertension, diabetes, and asthma, only half of them take their medicine. Nobody understands why. It's independent of them being able to afford the medicine. Half of them stop taking their medicine.
Wow.
So wow. A lot of mysteries out there.
Yeah.
People are hard to understand.
They are, especially if they have what will help them, the tools, the medicines,
yeah.
The ideas, and then they choose not to follow those suggestions.
Do you think that's because they don't think there's anything wrong with them, or they don't want to admit that they could improve? Or
well, I don't know, John. You know, these in the papers I have from the CDC and the World Health Organization, these are the people who are mostly filling emergency rooms because they're not taking their medicine, so they have asthma attacks and they have strokes if they're hypertensive. You know, they go into coma if they're diabetic and they're not taking their insulin. So they must know that they need the medicine. And yet, for some reason, half of them don't take their medicine. So go figure. I mean, why are people like that? It's a mystery.
Completely.
If you have any ideas, let me know.
I don't know. I'm just, I'm just trying to own my own stuff.
I know. So I tell you, I sit with my clients, after we're done with therapy, and I say to them, listen, I just want you to know that here's a fact. Half of all the people who have these chronic illnesses don't take their medicine. And in my book, they're in the idiots club. And I say to my clients, do you want to be in the idiots club or not? You stop using this stuff, your relationship is going to suck again. But if you use these things that we've worked on that have worked so well in therapy, and you use them every day, your relationship will soar. You'll have wings. But if you put this stuff in the hall closet and never look at it again, I guarantee you, you'll be back where you started. So it's your choice. And I say to them, can you think of situations where it's going to be hard to listen, where it's going to be tough to do this? And they can tell me. They'll say, yeah, I can't do it when her father's around because he doesn't like me. And she loves him, and I don't know what to do in that situation. I say, great, thank you. Let's work on that.
Right.
Let's work on what you do in that situation to be a great listener when you see she's upset. Okay, so we work on it. So there's a lot of mystery still in understanding how to help people.
And what they do with the help, which is what you just said, or what they don't do with it. I mean,
exactly.
And I think some of it is that people, they don't think as someone who is in a couple of dysfunctional relationships, and we'll just leave it there, there are people who don't think that there's anything fundamentally dysfunctional about the relationship or about their contributions to the relationship. And that makes it really difficult to fix things if they don't think anything is broken, or at least 50% of nothing is broken.
And if you don't take responsibility for your part in it, then, you'll never be able to fix it.
That's good stuff.
Dr. Gottman, if people want to learn about the Gottman Institute or where you will be hosting, I know you do events of several times a year in the Seattle area.
Yeah, we have 5 workshops a year. The last one we had 350 couples at our workshop.
Wow.
So we have 17 therapists who help these couples. We have a website that's gottman.com, gottman.com, and all the information is there. You can get it on your phone or your computer, and you can find a therapist with that website as well, because we've trained many therapists all over the world.
Oh, that's wonderful news. And then your books are available, I'm sure, online as well as in fine retail stores that sell books.
Right. Yeah, get the 7 Principles for Making Marriage Work and The Man's Guide to Women. That's probably the best. That contains all of the information we have. And if it's a problem with children, we have How to Raise an Emotionally Intelligent Child, which is all about this emotion coaching. So there are videos. There's a lot of stuff just on YouTube for free. And we have a lot of stuff that we have available for free on our website as well. If people can't afford it, there are ways of getting help at no cost as well.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gottman, for being part of True North Story. We sure appreciate you and all that you do to help families and couples develop better relationships and better communication.
Well, thank you, Tama. It was fun talking to you guys.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gottman. It's a pleasure to meet you and share in your wisdom. We certainly know that relationships are probably the single biggest thing in our lives that make our quality of life better or worse. So you're certainly doing your part to make them better, and we appreciate that.
Absolutely. I mean, they even can predict in a good love relationship, people will live 8 to 15 years longer than if they're alone or in a bad relationship. So they affect longevity and health in very big ways, as well as a man's eventual wealth and energy and motivation for life, his resilience to illness, all of those things, the way he copes with stress. So it's worth investing in a love relationship. Thank you, Tamara. Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter at True North Story. And tune in next time for another True North Story.